Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotter in Washington, D.C. Official campaigns and ahead of Senegal's legislative elections on Sunday.
These elections are also very important because its outcomes will determine the election in 2024 for the president of Senegal.
A political analyst says a presidential debate is not a major determinant of whom becomes Kenya's next president.
The debate cannot be used to determine. But this is not America, my friend. However, there is a small group of voters, mainly the undecided voter, who could have benefited from a debate.
And Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni forms an advisory group to help identify areas or sectors of export to significantly boost trade with regional and international partners.
Let's form a committee that combines the private and public sector, and this committee advises the president on the sectors to focus on for exports, the policies that need to be changed.
Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Senegal, official campaigns to elect representatives of the National Assembly ended Friday across the West African country. The election Sunday gives voters the opportunity to fill the 165 seats in the lawmaking body. This year's legislative elections come after a national dialogue aimed at easing political tension following the presidential polls in 2019. Opposition groups allege that the ruling party had an unfair advantage in the run-up to the vote, an accusation the group sharply denies. Analysts say the polls may test the popularity of President Macky Sall's government. For the latest development and expectations for Sunday's parliamentary elections, I read Senegalese political analyst Ibrahim Khan.
Expectations are very high because the opposition is expecting to have a kind of continuity in the vote of the Senegalese because they won recently a local election. And these elections are also very important because its outcomes will determine the election in 2024 for the president of Senegal. Because if the current incumbent party win the election, it will give, many people believe, it will give Macky Sall the strength to really try to get a third term.
So, Mr. Khan, are you saying that this election is important for both the opposition and the ruling party and could have a significant impact on whether President Macky Sall seeks a third and unprecedented term or not?
Exactly. Because a victory of Macky Sall coalition will mean that Macky Sall can easily start thinking of a third term, which is a kind of debate that is ongoing since 2 years now in Senegal. But a clear win for the opposition creates a condition for the first time in Senegal of the opposition leading the parliament and the president just running the executive, and which we have never seen that kind of scenario. But if the opposition win this time, which they think they will do, it will create an unprecedented situation in the country, politically speaking.
How credible do you think this election will be? And if there's any dispute, how will it be adjudicated?
You know, Senegal is used now to organizing elections. For at least 3 times, there was changing in the leadership because of transparent election. And we just do hope that this Sunday election will just confirm the continuity of the transparency in Senegalese election. I know that the last 3-4 days, there were rumor within the opposition that the list of voters was not presented to political parties in the time frame that is required by the law, meaning 15 days before the election. They just got it 4-5 days before the election. Since then, I didn't hear any contestation about the content of the document. So I believe that political parties are ready to use that document to participate in election. So far, today was the last day of the campaign, and all of them have done their bid. Just to say that the opposition was more concerned by the death of one of their partisans in Casamance, so that's why Sonko, Khalifa Sall, and other people went to Casamance to bury that person. Otherwise, everything is now set for Sunday election.
Has the Electoral Commission stated when the results of Sunday's election will come in, and do you expect all the parties to accept the outcome of the election?
I know for sure that as soon as the vote is ended and the vote is counted, each political party participating in the election will get a copy of the results. And those results are compiled at the level of the department, which is the county, if I can put it in that way, and then at the level of the region, and then at the national level. Now, at the level of the department, all the information is collated and copies of the results are given to all the political parties. And then until Friday, the collection of all these information are done. And Friday, officially, the provisional results of the election are set at the Court of Appeal. And if people are contesting the results so that they can make appeal before the court, and if the decision of the court is not accepted by those political parties, they can go now to the Constitutional Court, which is supposed to give the final result of the election. So this is the normal procedure. By Friday, we should get an idea of who won the election. And because it's just one vote, so by Friday, we should know who won the election.
Ibrahim Khan is a Senegalese political analyst. He spoke with me from the capital, Dakar. In Kenya, a political analyst says a presidential debate is not a major determinant of whom becomes the next president. Professor Herman Manyora, a lecturer at the University of Nairobi, says incumbent Deputy President William Ruto might not have convinced prospective voters that he is the best candidate to take over from outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta. His remarks come after all the presidential candidates except Ruto failed to turn up at the only presidential debate ahead of the August general election. Ruto had the stage all to himself for the 90-minute to answer questions and detail his plan for the country during the entire duration of the debate. The deputy president promised to reduce the cost of living and fight corruption if he is elected the next president. But his critics say he was unconvincing and appeared unprepared for some of the questions the moderators threw at him. Ruto faces a tough competition from Raila Odinga, a former prime minister who is currently ahead in recent opinion polls. For analysis of the latest political development, I reach Professor Herman Manyora.
The voters are divided, the country is divided. So those on the side of the man who turned up, deputy president, said he's a hero, he's quite somebody, and he's bold and courageous, and that the other fellow was afraid and scared. Equally, the other side is saying there was no point of debating such a man of such a dubious character, that would be kind of to sanitize him. So opinion is divided, as you would expect. That's how it is in this country today.
Prof, some people are suggesting that the refusal of the other presidential candidate to join the deputy president in this debate deprived Kenyans of the ability to determine who best is qualified to replace outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta. What is your take?
That presupposes that the debate would be used to determine who becomes president. And certainly that's not the case. The debate cannot, by any stretch of imagination, be used to determine. But this is not America, my friend. This is Kenya. However, there is a small group of voters, mainly the undecided voter, who could have benefited from a debate. That's true. Now, to that undecided group of voters who actually are undecided because they are critical and thinking about it and weighing things, they can look at it in whichever way they choose to look at it. There are those who will agree with the Raila side that what will be the benefit of this debating a man like this. But again, from that team of undecided voters, there are those who could say, you see, we knew Raila wasn't fit for this job. Not attending confirms our fears. And therefore, but basically, we cannot say that you can use a debate to determine a presidential candidate.
How did the deputy president perform? Because opponents or critics have described him as a paper tiger who was at times confused about the questioning and was getting his figures sometimes wrong.
You see, and I think, you know, people like Raila Odinga, they have been at this game for a while, you know. That would have been tactical on their part. That let this guy, let him be there, then he'll be exposed. And certainly he was exposed. He was not eloquent. He couldn't get to compose himself. He was out of his depth. You see, normally what Ruto is good at, if he's not attacking you, which is what he would have done if Raila was there, especially attack Uhuru Kenyatta, the other thing he's good at is hijacking the debate so that he sort of preaches. Now, the moderators were so sharp, they didn't give him the opportunity to preach. Now, at that point, you must prove that you are a good debater. You must prove that you are as intelligent as you have always said, because you must think on your feet, not rehearsed answers. So that's why those observations you are putting on the table are correct. Certainly he didn't come out very nice.
Prof, recent polls show that former Prime Minister Raila Odinga appears to have edged the Deputy President after the Deputy President has led in several polls leading up to now. Do you think the momentum is now shifting from the Deputy President, and can he catch up based on the campaigns on the ground that you have witnessed?
I think something out of the usual would have to happen for Ruto to now outpace Raila, because he was ahead for a long time, for a couple of years, 2-3 years. Then Raila came towards the end of last year, and then he began almost catching up with Ruto. Then he got to a point they were almost neck to neck. Then Raila has surged ahead, and with the remaining days and the way things are looking, it will need something very close to a miracle for Ruto to catch up with Raila and upstage him.
With the endorsement and support of outgoing President Uhuru Kenyatta, is this playing a crucial role on swinging the pendulum on the side of the former Prime Minister to clinch this title? And do you even foresee a runoff?
Anybody who dismisses the support of a sitting president will be naive from a political point of view, because that office is powerful. So when our president is supporting you, especially in a third world country like Kenya, it means a lot. And especially considering that the president comes from the most populous community, which, granted, doesn't like Raila Odinga, seems to have begun hating the president himself, but doesn't have a presidential candidate. And that Ruto is the one who has sort of claimed that territory politically. Now, the president will have some little influence, and that influence will translate into votes. Those votes will bolster Raila at the same time, while at the same time chipping away Ruto's numbers.
Professor Herman Manyora is a lecturer at the University of Nairobi. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. In Uganda, President Yoweri Museveni has formed an advisory group comprising the public and private sector players. It will help the president identify areas or sectors of exports to significantly boost trade with the country's regional and international partners. The committee is tasked with reviewing policies and measures with a renewed approach on how Uganda can increase trade with its neighbors and with wealthy nations, including the UK, the European Union, and the US. The move forms part of the government's plan to jumpstart the economy to create jobs and improve living standards. Odrek Rabwogo is a senior presidential advisor on special duties. He is currently visiting states and cities in the U.S. as part of the effort to identify key areas to help with Uganda's renewed approach to exports. I caught up with Rabwogo via Skype while he was in Washington, D.C. In part one of this interview, Rabwogo talks about Uganda's new approach to trade.
When we opened the economy after 2 years of COVID pandemic, we just found out that we had regressed. For the first time in 30 years, we grew 1%. So we thought for economies that are less on manufacturing, cash is like oxygen. And cash as a country, you get it from exports. So we began to look at the lucrative markets that were always supplied, but casually. So we looked at EU, we looked at Britain, and all the 50 Commonwealth countries that have history with Britain. We looked at the US, we looked at China. But the EU and the US, we speak one language. We have historical links. So we thought, how do you increase the oxygen in the room? By ensuring that you trade more in these countries you have had history with, but also, most importantly, you reach out. So we thought, let's form a committee that combines the private and public sector. And this committee advises the president on the sectors to focus on for exports, the policies that need to be changed, the standards that have to be created inside the country in order that our food and our products can be sold. And that's how I came to not just Washington. I've been in New York, I am in Chicago, talking to friends, talking to research companies, so that we can get some dipstick survey on what the country requires in order for it to sell here.
Typically, when African countries want to trade with the West, there are a standard of goods or commodities that usually the Western nations or wealthier nations do not want to compromise on. So looking at what you are doing right now, what do you think will be the take back to improve or to get to meet that standard in order to achieve your objective?
What I'm taking home is really that first, what you do internally determines what you achieve externally. So in our country, we're working on phytosanitary standards for all our food. We're working on export laws because you have to fulfill FDA requirements. We're working on technical and physical infrastructure in terms of aggregation of farmers' products at particular points where they are checked to an international standard before they are exported. One of the things I'm taking out of here is that you don't just walk into the market. It's a process. They have to look at your systems. They have to look at your producers. They have to abide by their particular rules for you to compete against Brazil and Colombia, which have a geographical and scale advantage. So we're taking lessons in that you have to go through people to get to these people. So there's good food, sourcing of good food, very good tourism potential, but very, very limited knowledge about the country. So it's a challenge that I'm thinking about. I spent 2 days with a group of researchers in an event called the Quacks. They happen, I think, 4 times a year in different parts of the world. And I just heard how much companies go through to be able to research the perception, the feelings, the market habits online of countries, of particular products, and I just felt overwhelmed. We are not in that space, and I'm taking back these lessons to see what we can do.
Now, Uganda, the last time I visited, saw its agricultural potential, its pineapples, avocados, bananas, and the likes. Now, I know it can be a breadbasket not only for the East African region, but the Central African region as well. How do you plan to maximize this potential, not only in these African areas, but abroad as well?
I speak about the US market not because we don't have regional markets. I speak about this market because it's a high price market. It's a high standard market. Plus, it teaches you to compete. I do not know any country, the Southeast Asian tigers, China, India, that is not in the US market. They go there not because they lack ASEAN market. They come here because here, you know, you are competing at a global scale. Our regional markets are very good. If I give you the market of DRC, Congo, which is in our neighborhood to the west, one city called Kinshasa has about 18 to 20 million people. In the last couple of years, we've opened up cooperation under one market for Africa. And we're looking at the geographic advantage we have with our avocados, because avocados come from Germany, France, into Congo. We're looking at these very sweet pineapples and bananas. We have these products because I think we have a mixture. We have like five different climates in Uganda. We have volcanic, we have temperate, we have savanna, we have tropical. We are able to give you a slice of each that you get, you know, not, you don't get very easily in many countries. We're on the equator. So we're looking at the new rapprochement that we have had with Congo. For example, we are building roads up to 500 kilometers combined, new roads in cooperation with Congo. We have gone together into Eastern Congo to deal with insecurity that has been there since 1960. And we think these are the markets that really don't require very much in terms of standard, and they are near us.
Odrek Rabwogo is a senior Ugandan presidential advisor on special duties. He spoke with me via Skype from here in Washington. In Zambia, Harry Kalaba, a former presidential candidate, says voters should watch for a new opposition party he plans to officially launch before the end of the year. This after he stepped down as leader and presidential candidate of the Democratic Party following sharp disagreements with some of the leaders of the party. Citing a prolonged court case over the leadership of the Democratic Party, Kalaba, also a former foreign minister, says he plans to launch a new party which he will lead to challenge incumbent President Hakainde Hichilema in the next general election. But critics say if he was not able to resolve a minor dispute with members of his own party about the top leadership of the group, Zambians should not trust him to effectively run the affairs of the country. They called him a quitter and not a true leader, an accusation Kalaba sharply rejects. For more on his decision to quit the opposition party with plans to launch a new group, I reach Harry Kalaba.
I have decided to move on because the sorrow that party had planted in the Democratic Party had hatched a plan to keep me in court for the next 2 or 3 years from what we gathered. We were not prepared to die a political death prepared by the Republican president. They took me to court over a simple matter of I was not properly elected as president of a party. I was thinking that the courts were going to adjudicate on this matter within a period of maybe 60 days. But that has not happened. This thing might go on up to 2025, a tactic President Hakainde Hichilema wants to use against a political rival. Having realized that, we said we're not going to stick in Democratic Party. For me, I'm not going to be part of the court process. My job is not to do politics in court.
You seem to have plans in place to form a new party. When should Zambians expect a new party that you form?
They must expect the party to be out soon. And we want to believe that before the end of this year.
But some people are suggesting that if you cannot handle your colleagues in the party and you have relinquished that party, how then should the people of Zambia trust you?
Everybody knows. That is why, Peter, I'm referring you to the audio, where the president is heavily involved because he's scared of Harry Kalaba.
Why do you think the president is scared of Harry Kalaba? He just won an election in an overwhelming fashion. And with the power of incumbents, it's fair to say that he's going to win the next election. So why do you think the president is scared of you?
Zambians are beginning to galvanize themselves against him. He will not get that vote. He didn't win the election last year because he was popular. He won because Zambians thought he was the only alternative. And I can assure you that he's got a tall order going into 2026. So he wants to begin eliminating political opponents by securing himself another term. We are going to stand up to him. And he should know that he and his sponsors are not going to determine the terms of reference for our country. Nor are they going to determine who our leader should be.
What makes you uniquely qualified that you think Zambians will decide to vote for you in the next general election?
What the country needs now is an experienced leader with experienced hands. They will want one who has been there before. I have been a civil servant myself for 10 years. I have been a minister. I've been a member of parliament for 8 years. So Zambians have seen how practical I have been. I have been giving practical solutions to the challenges that we are facing as a country.
Harry Kalaba is a former presidential candidate and a former foreign minister. He spoke with me from Zambia's capital, Lusaka. In Liberia, the Opposition Alternative National Congress, or ANC, is calling for an investigation into the violence against protesting students at the University of Liberia. The party also says those responsible for the attacks must be swiftly apprehended and prosecuted under the full force of the law to serve as deterrent. The demands come after some of the attackers targeting the protesting students were captured on video. The protest called Fix the Country campaign coincided with Liberia's independence celebrations on July 26. It was aimed at pressuring President George Weah to keep his promises and to solve the socioeconomic challenges facing the country. For more on the opposition ANC's party's call for a thorough inquiry into the violence, I reach Aloysius Stowe. He is the Secretary General of the opposition party.
We believe that under no condition should the government allow other citizens or finance other citizens to disrupt the right to protest by students of the University of Liberia on issues that they believe to be against the interest of the state.
Which state organ does your organization or party think should launch this investigation?
Our specific request has been to the Attorney General of the country to set up an independent panel of investigation. We hope that the Attorney General will yield to our call and set up a panel that will include the Civil Society of Liberia, international and partners.
In your press statement, you mentioned specific people you think carried out the violence. Do you have evidence implicating them? Because otherwise, it will be just defamation against them.
The individual named in our press statement were also named by some of the perpetrators. For instance, one of the guys who was seen in the open video claimed on his Facebook page that he was instructed to carry on the violence by Jefferson Koji. And it is a known fact that Jefferson Koji is... So the facts are clear, and all of these guys are involved in the violence that continue to be perpetrated against innocent people in this country.
When you say somebody is being shielded by the president, what do you mean? Is this just not a political slant on the president?
There are some facts that are responsible that the government is involved in this. One is there have been reports and the international community has been informed that the government is responsible for organizing, financing, and sponsoring the Sabu unit, the Kuba unit, and the Moscow Empire, a group of vigilante organizations and militants from the ruling party, who are organized to inflict havoc and injuries on opposition rallies and cause disruptions in the country. It's a known fact. The international community has been informed about it. As evidenced by this, there was disruption by these groups in Logan Town in District 15 in 2019 during an opposition rally led by Koji, Jefferson Koji, and another disruption in District 13 in 2018. When the opposition community was launching a rally where Koji led a group of thugs to disrupt the gathering and inflict injuries, and many people got wounded from that. So one does not need any further evidence to know the links of the government, especially the involvement. Koji has been openly involved in it. He's been part of some of these rallies, leading some of these violence attacks. There has been no action from the government. The logical conclusion that one can draw is that these acts are supported by the government.
Aloysius, has your party compiled video evidence to aid the Attorney General if he establishes a commission to investigate this violence meted out to these students during their protest?
Precisely. There is an overwhelming amount of video evidence available to any Attorney General if he ever chooses to launch any investigation. Social media is inundated with a lot of video evidence where individual peaceful protesting students have been arrested. They've been made naked and they've been forced to confess. And we have hoped that there will have been public outcry with this reckless and irresponsible behavior by thugs who are believed to be sponsored by the ruling party. Unfortunately, there has been no comment. There has been no statement from the government. There has been no statement from the Attorney General. And on account of this, we are demanding you know, as a matter of right, that the Attorney General launched an investigation in this gruesome, brutal attack against innocent civilians in the country.
Aloysius Stowe is the Secretary General of the Opposition Alternative National Congress. He spoke with me from the Liberian capital, Monrovia. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the African Development Bank and the International Monetary Fund, or IMF, say there is an urgent need for climate finance for Africa. The call came at a panel discussion on the bank's Africa's Economic Outlook that was hosted by the IMF in Washington. The theme for the discussion was supporting climate resilience and a just energy transition in Africa. It highlights climate change as a growing threat to livelihoods and lives on the continent. The African Economic Outlook 2022 focuses on supporting climate resilience and a just energy transition. Professor Kevin Chika-Urama is the acting chief economist and vice president for the Economic Governance and Knowledge Management Complex at the African Development Bank. He is here in Washington and participated in the panel discussion. In part one of a Skype interview with me, Professor Urama details the key findings of this year's African Economic Outlook. He adds that the study shows that the structure of climate finance is very complicated and may lead to a misallocation of resources. As a result, the main objective of climate finance to support climate vulnerable countries is not being achieved.
The main findings of the report are: one, the fact that Africa's economies have remained resilient after a contraction of 1.9% in 2020 because of COVID-19, we have seen growth rebound to 6.9% at the end of 2021. But the overlapping shocks of geopolitical tensions, including the Russia-Ukraine war, imported inflation, and debt overhang on the continent, is leading us to project that that growth will decelerate or decrease to about 4.1% in 2022 and 2023. So we also found that Africa will require over $432 billion to recover from COVID-19 effects, and it will take up to 10 years to be able to put the economies of the continent back to where it was in terms of poverty reduction to the pre-pandemic era. So that's really a grim picture. And we find that debt overhang and inflation are the major stressors, the major headwinds that African economies need to address at this stage.
How do you think Africa should prepare for COP27?
For me, one of the key things for COP27 should be that COP27 should be an implementation COP, not a COP of promises. Because as our own statesman Kofi Annan always said, only the promises kept are the promises that count. So the point here is that we've had 26 years of negotiations and conversations around climate change, climate finance, and so on. And to date, the $100 billion that's promised to the developing countries by the developed countries that has used up the carbon space of the carbon budget of the world are not yet met. So for me, Africa and the rest of the world should go to COP27 in Egypt, determined to make that commitment a reality in terms of financing for development in the developing world, to rebuild confidence amongst the global community that we're serious about climate change. And I would also want to see that the discussion around the true costs, loss and damages of climate change for countries need to be considered for rebuilding confidence by accelerating climate finance and also providing special set-aside resources to ensure that the more vulnerable countries to climate change will be able to receive climate finance, because today they are not receiving it.
Professor Rama, how is the Africa Development Institute of the bank working with African governments to improve capacity in governance, among other important issues on the continent?
Yes, the African Development Institute of the African Development Bank has really been a pace setter in terms of building capacity, institutional capacity for development on the continent. The board of the African Development Bank Group led by the president of the bank, President Adesina, as the chair of the board, has approved for us a capacity development strategy for Africa. They have also approved for us a strategy for economic governance in Africa. They have also approved for us a public financial management academy for Africa and a debt management, a debt action plan for Africa. All these strategies and instruments will allow the bank to accelerate its engagement on addressing many of the issues that will lead to structural reforms, governance improvements, and position Africa to be able to adapt to global headwinds that we always face, be it COVID-19, be it the climate challenges I've talked about, or geopolitical tensions that we see now that is creating spillover effects on the continent. Without having those institutional capacities shored up on the continent, we will remain vulnerable to some of these global shocks.
Professor Urama, you are here in Washington. Let me ask you what your mission is and what outcomes you expect.
Our mission in Washington basically are to meet with our traditional partners, the IMF, the World Bank, the Brookings Institution, Center for Global Development, and many other agencies that we normally work with. So we've come to discuss specific implementation actions to identify what they will cover and what we will cover so that together we can create economies of scale and make greater impacts in the way we are doing capacity development, technical assistance, knowledge management, policy dialogue, and advisory services to African governments. And then also to ensure that we can achieve the goal of the Paris Declaration on aid effectiveness, pulling together, coordinating together to ensure that we'll have greater impacts going forward.
Professor Kevin Chika Urama is the Acting Chief Economist and Vice President for the Economic Governance and Knowledge Management Complex at the African Development Bank. He spoke with me via Skype from here in Washington. Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
chwele uselala malunde Iskupu susa lo katele Pamila skaido Yeti zita zitukteli Itelu wa mega ngane gangane Ando le tulfusa balele Kukalo malunde Palandele na bobatelu chwele uselala malunde Iskupu susa lo katele Pamila skaido Yeti zita zitukteli Itelu wa mega ngane
I'm starta yedele yedele mengele 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 ulkisare sedele sedele spedele 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 starta yedele yedele mengele 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 ulkisare sedele sedele ene gustava kun shelele midnight kelele kapo sebele bula segele nar on 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 maradona dalla rof 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 and I'm on 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 fado della rof 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 and it goes baba con gelene big night gelene capo sebele bulla segele and it goes baba con gelene big night gelene capo sebele bulla segele.
Yo, 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 yo. Tiki, tiki, yo. barata kankani uthatile like sina kanjani tokorata maloba le maopani asbono no saka my love my smile keeper ane lerato ele cold drink when I utulita ene mina ngiyokuthanduso ka wena kikwala score angawina lotho ngawuregela Porsche. You got too much, too much, too much.
From the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Mike Hovey, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a man does not run among thorns for no reason. Either he is chasing a snake or a snake is chasing him. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.